The student of the good law has abundant opportunities of distributing blessings all about him unobtrusively, although the recipients may be quite unconscious of the source of that which comes to them. As mentioned in Chapter 11, when dealing with thought transference, physical association with a more highly evolved person may be of considerable help in the development and training of the mental body. Just as the heat radiations from a fire, warm articles placed near the fire, so may the thought radiations of a thinker stronger than ourselves cause our mental bodies to vibrate sympathetically with him. And for the time being we feel our mental power increased. An example of this effect often occurs at a lecture. A person in the audience appears whilst he is listening to the speaker to understand fully what is being said, but later the conception seems to grow dim and maybe completely elude the mind when an attempt is made to reproduce it. The explanation is that the masterful vibrations of the stronger thinker have at the time shaped the forms taken by the mental body of the listener, but afterwards the mental body is unable of its own power to resume those shapes. A true teacher will thus aid his disciples far more by keeping him near than by any spoken words. Unseen entities associated with ocean, mountain, forest, waterfalls, etc., radiate vibrations which awaken unaccustomed portions of mental, astral and etheric bodies, and hence, from this point of view, travel may be beneficial to all three bodies. In general, it may be said that everything which promotes health and well-being of the physical body reacts favorably also upon the higher vehicles. The converse, of course, is also true, the emotional and mental life having profound effects upon the physical body. For, while it is true that the mental and physical bodies are obviously, in the very nature of things, more amenable to the power of thought than is the physical body, yet the matter of even the physical body may be molded by the power of emotion and thought. Thus, for example, it is well known that any habitual line of thought, virtue or vice, makes its impress on the physical features, a phenomenon so common that its full significance has not perhaps been adequately realized by most people. Another example is that of the stigmata, appearing on the bodies of saints, many instances of which are on record. Innumerable other examples may be furnished from the literature of modern psychoanalysis and other sources. In the highly evolved fifth race man of today, in fact, the physical body is largely ruled by mental conditions, hence anxiety, mental suffering and worry, producing nervous tension, readily disturb organic processes and bring about weakness and disease. Right thought and feeling react upon the physical body and increase its power to assimilate prana or vitality. Mental strength and serenity thus directly promote physical health, for the evolved fifth race man lives his physical life literally in his nervous system. 2. The emotional life. The mental and astral bodies are so closely linked together as to produce profound effects upon one another. The intimate association between karma, desire, and manas, mind, and their actions and reactions on each other, have already been dealt with in Chapter 6 on Karma Manas. In this chapter we will deal merely with a few further incidental effects of the astral on the mental body, and also with the effect of the mental body on the astral body. A flood of emotion sweeping over the astral body does not itself greatly affect the mental body, although for the time it may render it almost impossible for any activity from that mental body to come through into the physical brain. That is not because the mental body itself is affected, but because the astral body, which acts as a bridge between the mental body and the brain, is vibrating so entirely at one rate as to be incapable of conveying any undulation which is not in harmony with that one rate. A typical example of the effect of powerful emotion on mental activity is afforded by a man in love. While in this state the yellow of intellect entirely vanishes from his aura, coarse sensuality in the astral body, which is represented by a peculiarly unpleasant hue, is quite incapable of reproducing itself in the mental body. This is an example of the principle that the matter of the various planes, as it becomes finer, gradually loses the power of expressing the lower qualities. Thus a man may form a mental image which evokes sensual feeling in him, but the thought and the image will express themselves in astral matter, and not in mental. It will leave a very definite impression of its peculiar hue upon the astral body, but in the mental body it will intensify the colors which represent its concomitant evils of selfishness, conceit and deception. It sometimes happens that certain groups of feeling and thought, some desirable, some undesirable, are closely linked together. Thus, for example, it is well known that deep devotion and a certain form of sensuality are frequently almost inextricably mingled. A man who finds himself troubled by this unpleasant conjunction may reap the benefit of the devotion, without suffering from the ill effects of the sensuality, by surrounding his mental body with a rigid shell so far as its lower subdivisions are concerned. In this way he will effectually shut out the lower influences while still allowing the higher to play upon him unhindered. This is but one example of a phenomenon of which there are many varieties in the mental world. The effect of the mental body on the astral body is, of course, considerable, and the student should pay close attention to this fact. He will recollect that each body is controlled ultimately by the body next above it. Thus the physical body cannot rule itself, but the passions and desires of the astral body can direct and control it. The astral body, in its turn, must be trained and brought under control by the mental body, for it is by thought that we can change desire and begin to transmute it into will, which is the higher aspect of desire. Only by the self as thought can be mastered the self as desire. The very sense of freedom in choosing between desires indicates that something higher than desire is operative, and that something higher is manas, in which resides free will, so far as anything lower than itself is concerned. The student will recollect also that the chakrams or force centers of the astral body are built and controlled from the mental plane, just as the physical brain centers were built from the astral plane. Every impulse sent by the mental body to the physical brain has to pass through the astral body, and as astral matter is far more responsive to thought vibrations than is physical matter, the effect on the astral body is proportionately greater. This process was dealt with in The Astral Body, p. 78, to which book the student is referred. Hence, as the vibrations of mental matter excite also those of astral matter, a man's thoughts tend to stir his emotions. Thus, as is well known, a man will sometimes, by thinking over what he considers his wrongs, easily make himself angry. The converse is equally true, though it is often forgotten. By thinking calmly and reasonably, a man can prevent or dismiss anger or other undesirable emotions. An example of the effect of a scientific and orderly habit of mind on the astral body is illustrated in Man Visible and Invisible on Plate 20, which portrays the astral body of a scientific type of man. The astral colors tend to fall into regular bands, and the lines of demarcation between them become clear and definite. In extreme cases, the intellectual development leads to the entire elimination of devotional feeling, and considerably reduces sensuality. The acquirement of concentration and, in general, the development of the mental body, also affects the dream life, and tends to make the dreams become vivid, well-sustained, rational, even instructive. The astral body, in fact, ought to be, and in a developed man is, merely a reflection of the colors of the mental body, indicating that the man allows himself to feel only what his reason dictates. Conversely, no emotion under any circumstances ought to affect the mental body in the least, for the mental body is the home, not of passions or emotions, but of thought. 3. The mental life. Although some little work in the building and devolution of a man's mind may be done from outside, yet most must result from the activity of his own consciousness. If, therefore, a man would have a mental body strong, well vitalized, active, able to grasp loftier thoughts presented to him, he must work steadily at right thinking. Each man is the person who most constantly affects his own mental body. Others, such as speakers and writers, affect it occasionally, but he always. His own influence over the composition of his mental body is far stronger than that of anyone else, and he himself fixes the normal vibratory rate of his mind. Thoughts which do not harmonize with that rate will be flung aside when they touch his mind. If he thinks truth, a lie cannot make a lodgment in his mind. If he thinks love, hate cannot disturb him. If he thinks wisdom, ignorance cannot paralyze him. The mind must not be allowed to lie as it were fallow, for then any thought seed may take root in it and grow, It must not be allowed to vibrate as it pleases, for that means it will answer to any passing vibration. A man's mind is his own, and he should allow entrance only to such thoughts as he, the ego, chooses. The majority of men do not know how to think at all, and even those who are a little more advanced rarely think definitely and strongly, except during the moments when they are actually engaged in some piece of work which demands their whole attention. Consequently, large numbers of minds are always lying fallow, ready to receive whatever seed may be sown in them. The vast majority of people, if they will watch their thoughts closely, will find that they are very largely made up of a casual stream of thoughts which are not their own thoughts at all, but simply the cast-off fragments of other people's. The ordinary man hardly ever knows exactly of what he is thinking at any particular moment, or why he is thinking of it. Instead of directing his mind to some definite point, he allows it to run riot, or lets it lie fallow, so that any causal seed cast into it may germinate and come to fruition there. A student who is earnestly trying to raise himself somewhat above the thought of the average man should bear in mind that a very large proportion of the insurgent thought which is so constantly pressing upon him is at a lower level than his own, and, therefore, he needs to guard himself against its influence. There is a vast ocean of thought upon all sorts of utterly unimportant subjects that it is necessary to strive rigidly to exclude it. This is one reason why to tile the lodge is the constant care of every Freemason. If a man will take the trouble to form the habit of sustained and concentrated thought, he will find that his brain, trained to listen only to the promptings of the ego, the real thinker, will remain quiescent when not in use, and will decline to receive and respond to casual currents from the surrounding ocean of thought, so that it will no longer be impervious to influences from the higher planes, where insight is keener and judgment truer than it ever can be down here. It is only when the man can hold his mind steady, can reduce it to quietude, and keep it in that condition without thinking, that the higher consciousness can assert itself. Then is the man ready to enter on the practice of meditation and yoga, as we shall see in due course. That is the practical lesson in training the mental body. The man who practices it will discover that by thinking life can be made nobler and happier, and that it is true that by wisdom an end can be put to pain. The wise man will watch his thought with the greatest care, realizing that in it he possesses a powerful instrument, for the right use of which he is responsible. It is his duty to govern his thought lest it should run riot and do evil to himself and others. It is his duty to develop his thought power because by means of it a vast amount of good can be done. Reading does not build the mental body, thought alone builds it. Reading is valuable only as it furnishes materials for thought, and a man's mental growth will be in proportion to the amount of thought he expends in his reading. With regular and persistent but not excessive exercise, the power of thinking will grow just as muscle power grows by exercise. Without such thinking, the mental body remains loosely formed and unorganized. Without gaining concentration, the power of fixing the thought on a definite point, thought power cannot be exercised at all. The law of life, that growth results from exercise, thus applies to the mental body just as it does to the physical body. When the mental body is exercised and made to vibrate under the action of thought, fresh matter is drawn in from the mental atmosphere and is built into the body, which thus increases in size as well as in complexity of structure. The amount of the thought determines the growth of the body, the quality of the thought determines the kind of matter employed in that growth. We may profitably consider the method of reading a little more in detail. In a book that is carefully written, each sentence or paragraph contains a clear statement of a definite idea, the idea being represented by the author's thought form. That thought form is usually surrounded with various subsidiary forms which are the expressions of corollaries of necessary deductions from the main idea. In the mind of the reader there should be built up an exact duplicate of the author's thought form, perhaps immediately, perhaps by degrees. Whether the forms indicating corollaries also appear depends on the nature of the reader's mind, that is, whether he is quick to see in a moment all that follows from a certain statement. A mentally undeveloped person cannot make a clear reflection at all, but builds up a sort of morphous incorrect mass, instead of a geometrical form. Others may make a recognizable form, but with blunted edges and angles, or with one part out of proportion to the rest. Others may make a kind of skeleton of it, showing that they have grasped the outline of the idea, but not in any living way and without any details. Yet others may touch one side of the idea and not the other, thus building half the form, or seize upon one point and neglect the rest. A good student will reproduce the image of the central idea accurately and at once, and the surrounding ideas will come into being one by one as he revolves the central idea in his mind. One of the principal reasons for imperfect images is lack of attention. A clairvoyant can often see a reader's mind occupied with half a dozen subjects simultaneously. In his brain are seething household cares, business worries, memory and anticipation of pleasures, weariness at having to study, and so forth, these occupying 9/10 of his mental body, leaving the remaining 1/10 to make a despairing effort to grasp the thought form he is supposed to be assimilating from the book. The result of such fragmentary and desultory reading is to fill the mental body with a mass of little, unconnected thought forms like pebbles, instead of building up in it an orderly edifice. It is clear, therefore, that in order to be able to use the mind and the mental body effectively, training in paying attention and concentration are essential, and the man must learn to clear his mind of all extraneous and irrelevant thoughts whilst he is studying. A trained student may, through the thought form of the author, get into touch with the mind of the author, and obtain from him additional information or light on difficult points, though, unless the student is highly developed, he will imagine that the new thoughts which come to him are his own instead of those of the author. Remembering that all mental work done on the physical plane must be done through the physical brain in order to succeed, the physical brain must be trained and ordered so that the mental body can work readily through it. It is well known that certain parts of the brain are connected with certain qualities in the man, and with his power to think along certain lines. All these must be brought into order and duly correlated with the zones in the mental body. A student of occultism, of course, trains himself deliberately in the art of thinking, consequently, his thought is much more powerful than that of the untrained man, and is likely to influence a wider circle and to produce a much greater effect. This happens quite outside his own consciousness without his making any specific effort in the matter. But because the occultist has learned the tremendous power of thought, his responsibility in the right use of it is proportionately the greater, and he will take pains to utilize it for the helping of others. A warning may not be out of place to those who have a tendency to be argumentative. Those who are easily provoked to argument should recollect that when they rush out eagerly to verbal battle, they throw open the doors of their mental fortress, leaving it undefended. At such times, any thought forces which may happen to be in their neighborhood can enter and possess their mental bodies. While strength is being wasted over points which are often of no importance, the whole tone of their mental bodies is being steadily deteriorated by the influences which are flowing into it. The occult student should exercise great care in permitting himself to enter into arguments. It is a common experience that argument seldom tends to alter the opinion of either side. In most cases, it confirms the opinions already held. Every hour of life gives opportunity for consciousness to build up the mental vehicle. Waking or sleeping, we are ever building our mental bodies. Every quiver of consciousness, though it be due only to a passing thought, draws into the mental body some particles of mental matter and shakes out other particles from it. If the mental body is made to vibrate by pure and lofty thoughts, the rapidity of the vibrations causes particles of the coarser matter to be shaken out and their place is taken by finer particles. In this way, the mental body can be made steadily finer and purer. A mental body thus composed of finer materials will give no response to coarse and evil thoughts. A mental body built of gross materials will be affected by evil passers-by and will remain unresponsive to and unbenefited by the good. The above applies more specifically to the form side of the mental body. Turning to the life side, the student should also bear in mind that the very essence of consciousness is constantly to identify itself with the not-self, and as constantly to reassert itself by rejecting the not-self. Consciousness, in fact, consists of this alternating assertion and negation: I am this, I am not this. Hence consciousness is, and causes in matter, the attracting and repelling that we call vibration. Thus the quality of the vibrations set up by the consciousness determines the fineness or coarseness of the matter which is drawn into the mental body. As we saw in Chapter 11, the thought vibrations of another, whose thoughts are lofty, playing on us tend to arouse vibrations in our mental bodies of such matter as is capable of responding, and these vibrations disturb and even shake out some of that which is too coarse to vibrate at his high rate of activity. Hence the benefit we receive from another is largely dependent upon our own past thinking because, to be beneficially affected, we must first have in our mental bodies some of the higher types of matter which his thought can affect. The mental body is subject to the laws of habit just as are the other vehicles. Hence, if we accustom our mental bodies to a certain type of vibration, they learn to reproduce it easily and readily. Thus, for example, if a man allows himself to think evil of others, it soon becomes easier habitually to think evil of them than good. In such ways often arise prejudices which blind a man to the good points of others, and enormously magnify the evil in them. Many persons, through ignorance, fall into habits of evil thought. It is, of course, equally possible to form habits of good thoughts. It is not a difficult matter to train oneself to look for the desirable rather than the undesirable qualities in the people whom we meet. Hence will arise the habit of liking, rather than disliking people. By such practices, our minds begin to work more easily along the grooves of admiration and appreciation instead of along those of suspicion and disparagement. A systematic use of thought power will thus be make life easier and pleasanter, and also build the right kind of matter into our mental bodies. Many people do not exercise their mental abilities as much as they should do. Their minds are receptacles rather than creators, constantly accepting other people's thoughts instead of forming their own from within. A realization of this fact should induce man to change the attitude of his consciousness in daily life and to watch the working of his mind. At first, considerable distress may be felt when a man perceives that much of his own thinking is not his own at all, that thoughts come to him he knows not whence, and take themselves off again he knows not whither, that his mind is little more than a place through which thoughts are passing. Having reached this preliminary stage of mental self-consciousness, a man should next observe what difference there is between the condition of thoughts when they come into his mind and when they go out of it, that is, what it is that he himself has added to them during their stay with him. In this way his mind will rapidly become really active and develop its creative powers. Next the man should choose with the utmost deliberation what he will allow to remain in his mind. When he finds there a thought that is good, he will dwell upon it and strengthen it, and send it out again as a beneficent agent. When he finds in his mind a thought that is evil, he will promptly eject it. The careless play of thought on undesirable ideas and qualities is an active danger, creating a tendency towards such undesirable things, and leading to actions embodying them. A man who dallies in thought with the idea of an evil action may find himself performing it before he realizes what he is doing. When the gate of opportunity swings open, the mental action rushes out and precipitates action. For all action springs from thought. Even when action is performed, as we say, without thought, it is nevertheless the instinctive expression of the thoughts, desires and feelings which the man has allowed to grow within himself in earlier days. After pursuing steadily for some time this practice of choosing what thoughts he will harbor, the man will find that fewer and fewer evil thoughts flow into his mind, that such thoughts, in fact, will be thrown back by the automatic action of the mind itself. His mind also will begin to act as a magnet for all the similar thoughts that are around him. Thus the man will gather into his mental body a mass of good material, and his mental body will grow richer in its content every year. Thus we see that the great danger to be avoided is that of allowing the creation of thought images to be incited from without, of allowing stimuli from the outer world to call up images in the mental body, to throw the creative mental matter into thought forms, charged with energy, which will necessarily seek to discharge and thus realize themselves. In this ungoverned activity of the mental body lies the source of practically all our inner struggle and spiritual difficulties. It is ignorance which permits this undisciplined functioning of the mental body, that ignorance should be replaced by knowledge, and we should learn to control our mental bodies, so that they are not roused from without to making images, but are ours to use as we will. An immense amount of suffering is caused by undisciplined imagination. The failure to control the lower passions, especially sex desire, is the result of an undisciplined imagination, not of a weak will. Even though strong desire is felt, it is creative thought which brings about action. There is no danger in merely seeing or thinking about the object of desire, but when a man imagines himself as giving way to his desires, and allows the desires to strengthen the image he has made, then his danger begins. It is important to realize that there is no power in objects of desire as such, unless and until we indulge in imaginations which are creative. Once having done this, struggle is certain to ensue. In this struggle we may call upon what we think is our will, and try to escape from the results of our own imaginings by frantic resistance. Few have learnt that anxious resistance inspired by fear are very different from will. The will should rather be employed to control the imagination in the first instance, thus eradicating the cause of our troubles at its source and origin. As we shall see in a later chapter, the materials which we gather during the present life are, in the after-death life, worked up into mental powers and faculties which will find further expression in our future lives. The mental body of the next incarnation depends on the work we are doing in our present mental body. Karma brings the harvest according to our sowing. We cannot isolate one life from another, nor miraculously create something out of nothing. As it is written in the Chandogya Upanishad, man is a creature of reflection, that which he reflects on in this life he becomes the same hereafter. To combat and change habits of thought, a process which involves ejecting from the mental body one set of mental particles and replacing them by others of a higher type, is naturally difficult at first, just as it is usually difficult at first to break physical habits. But it can be done and, as the old form changes, right thinking becomes increasingly easy, and finally spontaneous. There is hardly any limit to the degree to which a man may recreate himself by concentrated mental activity. As we have seen, schools of healing such as Christian Science, Mental Science, and others utilize this powerful agency in obtaining their results, and their utility largely depends upon the knowledge of the practitioner as to the forces which he is employing. Innumerable successes prove the existence of the force. Failures show that the manipulation of it was not skillful or could not evoke sufficient for the task in hand. Expressed in general terms, thought is the manifestation of creativeness, the third aspect of the human triplicity. In Christian terminology, will is the manifestation of God the Father, love of God the Son, and thought, or creative activity, of God the Holy Ghost. For it is thought in us which acts, which creates, and carries out the decrees of the will. If the will is the king, thought is the prime minister. The occultist applies this creative power to quicken human evolution. Eastern yoga is the application of the general laws of the evolution of mind to this quickening of the evolution of a particular consciousness. It has been proved, and can ever be reproved, that thought, concentrating itself attentively on any idea, builds that idea into the character of the thinker, and a man may thus create in himself an desired quality by sustained and attentive thinking, by meditation. Knowing this law, a man can build his own mental body as he wishes it to be, as certainly as a bricklayer can build a wall. The process of building character is as scientific as that of developing muscular power. Even death does not stop the work, as we shall see in later chapters. In this work, prayer may be used with great effect, perhaps the most striking instance being found in the life of the Brahman. The whole of that life is practically one continuous prayer. Though much more elaborate and detailed, it is somewhat similar to the form used in some Catholic convents where the novice is instructed to pray every time that he eats, that his soul may be nourished by the bread of life, every time he washes that his soul may be kept pure and clean, every time he enters a church, that his life may be one long service, and so on. The life of the Brahman is similar, except that his devotion is on a larger scale and is carried into much greater detail. No one can doubt that he who really and honestly obeys all these directions must be deeply and constantly affected by such action. As we saw in Chapter 4, The mental body has this peculiarity, that it increases in size as well, of course, as in activity, as the man himself grows and develops.